Today we're going to begin by talking about the generalized harmonic formulation of the Einstein equations. So there are sort of different ways one can formulate the Einstein equations as evolution equations that have nice hyperbolic properties. So in the tutorial you worked out this BSSN form where you do this variation on the 3 plus 1 decomposition and you get a nice hyperbolic form. Today we're going to talk about a different formulation where you don't have to do this 3 plus 1 splitting. We kind of get this like nice wave-like wave operation like form for the Einstein equations. But before we do that, I'm going to first do a kind of example, not in GR, but in Maxwell's equations that'll have a lot of the same features that will apply to the Einstein equations. So as a warm-up, let's consider Maxwell's equations as a evolution of the vector field, just in vacuum and in flat space for simplicity. So we have that equals 0. And then if we write that in terms of the vector field, we have that. And so, you know, written this way, we might think, OK, we have some second, you know, we have basically four second order equations, you know, one for each index b, right? So, you know, why can't we just choose some initial data that gives us a vector field and its initial time derivative t equals 0, and then just evolve according to this, and everything should be fine, right? So it turns out that doesn't work, basically because not all four of these are actually evolution equations, just in the same way that not all of Einstein's equations are evolution equations, some are constraints. So to see that explicitly, let's just look at the t component. So set b equal to t. Look at that component of the equation. So we're going to write this out. In terms of the time and spatial part. And then here we get so just wrote that out for B, but then we can immediately see the problem, right? So this one cancels out with this one, right? So now we don't have any second time derivatives in the t equation. And in fact, you know, this equation should be familiar. So that's just the constraint equation. And if we go back to the electric and magnetic fields, you can recognize that as just the constraint that dV equals 0 since we don't have any sources. So this is just the constraint. So it's the same thing as in the Einstein equations. Some of the equations, naively, you think they'd all be sort of second order in time, but you know, we have the Hamiltonian constraint, the momentum constraint. And then, of course, you know, we shouldn't be surprised by this, right? Because we know this is A is just a gauge field, right? We have some freedom on how to choose the gauge that we want. And we haven't, basically, the equations don't know what gauge we've chosen because we haven't put that in yet. So you can actually fix these equations basically by making a gauge choice and substituting that in, and in that way make them manifestly hyperbolic. So if we choose the Lorentz gauge, Then we can substitute this in, right here, and basically get rid of this extra term. And now we just have some nice wave equations for each component. And we can also just check that, if we start with this, so we can enforce this Lorentz gauge at t equals zero, but then these equations basically fully determine the evolution rate. So we can check that if we start some initial data that satisfies this and just evolve according to this, we want to preserve that, right? And, it's easy to check just by applying another, applying partial B to here and just commuting through. We get that basically the Lorentz condition itself satisfies this, propagates like a wave equation, right? So if we start with initially being satisfied, then it should be satisfied for all future times. Yeah, so today we're basically going to do the same thing, but for the Einstein equations. We're going to make a sort of convenient gauge choice that'll, and then substitute that in, and then we should get some nice wave equations for the Einstein equations. And then we want to check that basically if we initially satisfy this gauge condition, that it'll propagate through according to evolution equations. So first I'm going to just write down Einstein equations in a kind of suggestive form. So first, let's just start with the Einstein equations in the trace reversed form. So we just have the Ricci tensor over here and some matter terms over there. And then we can write out this Ricci tensor. Okay, and here, so the way I've written this, we have this nice wave operator for each of the metric functions here, which is sort of, if we just had that, we'd be denoting, be sort of manifestly hyperbolic. This term we don't really need to worry about because it's not the principal part, right? It's just the first derivatives. But then here is kind of the problematic term. Oops, I forgot one of these. And so this is the problematic term. So here I'm kind of introducing some new notation where this gamma A is basically another contraction of the Christoffel symbols. So if you just lower the first index in the Christoffel symbol and then contract these, that's gamma A. And because you know, this involves first derivatives of the metric, second derivatives of the metric, this term involves second derivatives of the metric as well, so it also contributes to the principal part. And so that's the one that kind of spoils the hyperbolicity of the equations. So the trick we're going to use is basically to introduce or basically fix our gauge degrees of freedom by sort of specifying these functions. And yeah, before I do that, I should note that this is actually equal to minus the box of the coordinates. So let me write that another way. So here I'm writing here. So here by box I mean two covariate derivatives contracted with each other. And here I just mean basically these are four different functions. Each of them is just the coordinate. So, you know, t and then the three coordinates or whatever coordinates you're using. And if we work that out, that's actually equal to minus this gamma A. So what we're going to do is we're going to fix our gauge degrees of freedom by requiring box A, or equivalently minus gamma A, to be equal to some functions that we specify. And I'm going to call those HA, and those will be the source functions. And we're going to think of then HA as independent variables. And we'll talk about different choices for HA in a second, but for example, the simplest one would be to just set them to zero as a gauge choice. Yeah, so the idea is we can use this condition and basically substitute that into the Einstein equations and then get rid of these terms. And just as a bit of terminology, you know, because functions that satisfy, you know, the box operator equals zero are called harmonic functions. This formulation is called the generalized harmonic formulation because you're letting the box of the coordinates be some function that you specify. All right, so then with that substitution, And that's equal to our matter source terms, if we have any. So this is just using this equals this. And so now we have this nice principal part, and all the other terms are our first derivative terms. So they don't affect our principal part. So we do have to specify some evolution equation in general for these source terms. But in most cases, you know, we don't actually need to evolve h of a. So the simplest choice would just be to set it to 0. Which is just called harmonic gauge. So I think in your next problem set, you work out what a black hole solution looks like in harmonic coordinates, as well as what like a FRW solution does as well. Sometimes just setting to 0 doesn't have desired properties. So in general, if you just set it to be some function of the metric, then as long as it isn't as long as it doesn't involve derivatives of the metric, then you won't spoil the hyperbolicity of your equations, because you just have first derivative is h here. So if h is first derivative of the metric, then you're back to where you began. You can spoil the hyperbolicity, but if it's just some explicit function of the metric, then you're fine. The basic idea is then you just evolve the metric, its first derivative, in the general case, you could evolve the source functions and their first derivative. Or you could just choose a gauge where it's just some function of the metric, and then you don't really need to evolve those as well. For the same reason that the wave equation is manifestly hyperbolic, each of the metric components themselves, since they satisfy this wave equation, will be manifestly hyperbolic. As long as your time coordinate is a good time coordinate. Okay, but we're not quite done because we're saying that we're going to require the source functions to equal box of the metric, but that's really something we can only that we don't get to enforce, right? For example, if we just chose harmonic gauge, we would just evolve according to these equations. And then at any given time, you could compute what box of the coordinates was. So how do we know that it's guaranteed to be 0 at some later time? Yeah, so to do that, we want to determine how this constraint evolves with time. So let's define CA to basically be the difference between the source functions and box of the coordinates. And we want to know if this equals 0 for all time. So basically, when I got this equation from this equation, I basically just added some function of CA, right? That's how I swapped out HA from gamma A. So if I return those terms to the equations, basically I just have the following. So basically, all I did was add these derivatives of these constraints to the Einstein equations, right? So that's what my evolution equations are. And so if we take these and project with NA and B, or the projection operator, like that, on the left-hand side, what do we get? Yeah, that's what we did in class a couple times ago when we did the decomposition, right? So this is the unit normal to slices of constant time. Yeah, so for this one, this is basically just taking the time component of the Einstein equations. What do we get? N1. Yeah, so that's how we derive the Hamiltonian constraint, right? And then for this one, what was that? Momentum constraint, yeah. So basically, we know that we're gonna have this equals basically Hamiltonian constraint, and so on, and equivalently with this one. So basically, if we choose initial data that satisfies the constraints, like we talked about last class, how to do that, and we, yeah, and we choose initially, if we choose initial slice where CA equals 0, which is easy to do, right? We just take the box of our coordinates and set HA to that initially. Then what this tells us is that if we, yeah, so if we have CA equals 0 and we satisfy the Hamiltonian momentum constraints, this and this and this are 0, and so that means that we must have that the time derivatives of CA are 0 at t equals 0, right? Yeah, so yeah, now I just want to check how they evolve with time. Yeah, so let's just take the trace of this and then subtract that out. So we can rewrite this way. right, and then we take our evolution equation, and then we're gonna apply a covariant derivative to both sides. So yeah, so basically apply covariant derivatives like to A to both sides. So if we apply it here, what do we get? It's that identity we always use. Yeah, so to take the covariant. What is that? Or maybe first, what is this tensor in parentheses?
The Einstein tensor.
Yeah. So what's the divergence of the Einstein tensor? Zero, yeah. And that's the starts with the B. The Bjarke identity. So that one's zero. Then we get that. What's that gonna be? The divergence of the stress energy tensor should just be, yeah, just zero if we satisfy stress energy conservation. So that's the Bjarke identity. That's stress energy conservation. And then over here we have, so that's, we got zero for those terms. And then over here we get way. Okay, so we just took the apply this to this side and expanded these symmetrization operations. And yeah, and then we have, yeah, we basically want to exchange this one with that one so we can cancel out this one. But then if we do that in general, we'll pick up a Ricci tensor term, right? So we're basically left with this. So that this is our evolution of the constraints. So basically, if we evolve with these equations, which are the same as this basically, then that implies that our constraints evolve like this. But again, we can see we just actually have a nice wave equation for the constraints themselves, right? With just some extra curvature source term. But what we just argued over here is that, you know, we can set this constraint to be zero on the initial time slice. That's just setting the source functions to be box the coordinates. And then if we have initial data that satisfies the Hamiltonian momentum constraint, which of course we'd want, then the first time derivative of CA is zero as well. So basically that these two conditions provide the initial data. This provides the evolution, and then you can we expect to get a unique solution, which is obviously just C equals zero everywhere. So any questions about that? Yeah, so just as a side note, mathematically, CA is guaranteed to be zero for all time. For example, if you're numerically evolving these equations, you would never exactly satisfy identities like this, but sort of a good check that you're evolving the right equations is to basically check that these are converging to zero. So if you are doing a numerical calculation and you compute some norm of your constraints as a function of time, then usually if you do them at one resolution, get some answer, and then you add more numerical resolution, and they should become much smaller, and then more, and they can get even smaller. And this is actually a very non-trivial check that you're constraints are converging to zero as you evolve, because you can see that basically anything you could mess up will sort of show up as your evolution equations not actually corresponding to these constraints being satisfied as you evolve with time. So if you don't solve the Hamiltonian momentum constraints fully at the initial time slice, then you'll basically end up with some time derivative of the constraints, which will make it start growing. If you try to couple your evolution equations to some matter, but the way you're evolving the matter doesn't actually correspond to the stress energy tensor being conserved, then you also won't have this property, right? Because we just dropped this stress energy conservation term there, right? But if that's not zero, then that'll basically also show up as some extra source term for the constraints. So it's a sort of highly non-trivial check that you're doing everything correctly. But another thing to note is that actually, if you just evolve these equations in situations, for example, with black holes or things like that, actually, you won't find that the constraints kind of look like this. In fact, what you'll find is that you'll get exponentially growing modes. So you can start with some tiny amount of constraint violation, and it'll just want to grow exponentially in time. If you add more resolution, you'll start with a smaller initial constraint violation, but it still wants to go exponentially with time. So this is basically, you don't have any guarantees for what the solution is going to do off the constraint preserving manifold, right? This argument here basically just said that if you start with something, if they're exactly satisfied, they'll be exactly satisfied for all time. But that doesn't stop you from having these constraint violating modes potentially growing exponentially. And so that was actually one of the big things people struggled with when they were first trying to, do simulations of binary black holes merging. They found that, these constraints would sort of grow exponentially with time, and if they grow too fast, there's kind of nothing you can do. If you try to add more resolution, that just gets you another few e-folds of evolution before things break down. So there, the sort of solution that people actually figured out is, there's no reason I can't sort of add additional functions of CA to this equation here, right? That's just going to affect what the solution does sort of in the, off the constraint preserving manifold. And in particular, if I don't, as long as I don't add derivatives of CA like I did before, so I added derivatives of CA to basically get the right principal part I wanted. But if I just add some function of CA without derivatives to these equations as well, then I'll still have the same principal part, but I can potentially affect what the solution will do off the constraint preserving manifold. And so the solution actually turns out to be to add a term like this. So if we add this to, let me call this equation star. And then we work out how that changes this equation. And so here kappa is just some constant that has dimensions of 1 over length, as we'll see in a second. Yeah, so basically, this acts like constraint damping, and this basically 1 over k is the damping time scale or length scale, and of course if for solutions to the Einstein equations this is zero, so we're not actually changing things, and you can still see that. This evolution equation, if we start with initial data where it's zero, it should remain zero. But this basically serves to damp any violations of the constraints. Yeah, and basically, with these extra terms, that was how the first binary black hole calculations were performed. Yeah. So, any questions about the generalized harmonic formulation before we switch gears? important. Okay, so far we've been talking about, how to evolve the Einstein equations and think of things in the dynamical setting. So for the rest of the class, I want to talk about how we could actually define black holes and, basically the boundaries or horizons in a dynamical setting, just given some information about what the solution is. At some time, as opposed to the sort of the whole solution being given to you. In particular, we'll introduce the concept of an apparent horizon. But before I get to that, let's begin by reviewing the other definition of a black hole, which is the event horizon. So, an event horizon, so to give a kind of precise definition of that, that's the boundary of the causal past of future null infinity. Or kind of in symbols, the black hole is B, where we have our manifold M, and then we subtract out the causal past, J minus, of future null infinity, scribe plus, and the event horizon is the boundary of B. So that's a bit technical, so let's draw a picture basically. So first of all, just to make sure everyone's on the same page for these like Penrose or conformal diagrams, I guess we talked about that briefly the first week, but just in case you haven't seen it before, let's review it again. So for these Penrose diagrams, so first of all, let's just draw the one for flat space, which just looks like a triangle. So the idea here is, for example, we could compactify our radial coordinate and then suppress all the angular components. So basically just have roughly, we have like space and then time. And the rule for these conformal diagrams is that light or null rays always are at a 45-degree angle, so that horizontal corresponds to a space-like curve, and vertical corresponds to a time-like curve. So, for example, and right, and so this point is spatial infinity. So basically, any space, like. So any slices of constant time would be like this. This corresponds, this null surface here corresponds to past null infinity. So for example, if we had light that started very far away and then started focusing down on so if you had some incoming light that was going in towards the what you're defined to be the center. This incoming light would be like this. If you had some time-like observer, it might have a trajectory like this. If you emitted some outward-going null rays or gravitational signal or something, that would look like this, again at 45 degrees. And I would go outward to future null infinity, where you kind of extract, you know, radiation or a gravitational signal or things like that. So that's just flat space. And then for a Schwarzschild solution, or kind of ignore the other copies of the in the white hole and so forth. You know, here you have future null infinity, past null infinity, space-like infinity. The black hole singularity is here, and this is the event horizon, basically, because you take future null infinity, you look at its causal past, so that means just go send light rays back, and that sort of covers all this part of the space-time or manifold. And the part that is not covered right here is the black hole. And the boundary of that, you know, the boundary between the light rays that make it to future null infinity and those that don't, is the event horizon. So that's the one for kind of an eternal Schwarzschild black hole. But, you know, maybe a more realistic setting is one where you take some matter and it collapses and forms a black hole. So the conformal diagram for that would look something like this. So let's say we have some matter here and then it collapses. So then this is scry minus, scry plus, spatial infinity. And then we define the event horizon basically by taking this point and drawing a 45 degree line, which basically divides where signals can go out to future null infinity and where they remain inside the black hole, right? Okay, so that's an event horizon. But in this dynamical setting, you know, there's some reasons to sort of give you pause about this definition of event horizon. So one, basically, this definition requires you to know everything that'll happen all the way into the future, right? You need to know the whole history of your space-time, right? In order to decide whether or not, you know, a signal will make it out to future null infinity or not. So, you know, in particular, if you're just, you know, evolving things forward in time, like you have this slice and you have this slice and so on, by this definition, you can't know if you have a black hole or where the boundary of the black hole is, just using information on the slice, right? Because you need to evolve all the way to the future to determine by this definition. Another word that people like to use in this context is that to say that the event horizon is teleological, which basically means that it can anticipate the future. Yeah, so you imagine, imagine we're, there's a huge shell of matter that's, very far away from the Earth, but surrounding it, and it's moving towards us, and eventually, and it's, collapsing, and right, and so, and just for simplicity, let's say that the shell is, very thin, it's and it's, with some radius r that's decreasing as a function of time. So basically, applying Birkhoff's theorem, we expect, the solution outside this shell mass So basically, we expect the solution outside R to be like a Schwarzschild solution, and then inside it'll be like flat space. And when basically when R equals to 2m, then we expect to, in some sense, form a black hole, right? But according to this definition, if we have, so we have this collapsing, let's just say it's a collapsing matter shell. According to this definition here, if we, so let's say at this point, r equals 2m, so that we have a Schwarzschild solution all the way to the future outside the event horizon, right? But according to this definition of the event horizon, if we consider someone at the center, r equals 0, actually already at this point, they're inside the event horizon, right? The matter shell hasn't collapsed. They could still be at very large distances, but they're already inside the event horizon. They just don't know it yet, right? Basically, because if they, send out a light ray, it can move outwards. It can move outwards fine, but then at some later time, the shell will collapse enough that that light ray will be stuck. And somehow, this definition of the event horizon knows that this will happen in the future and says, at this time, you're already inside the event horizon. So that's the sense in which this event horizon is teleological. So any questions about that? Yeah, so we're going to introduce an alternative or another concept, which is the apparent horizon, which we'll define on a given time slice. All right, so to do this, we need to introduce a little bit of terminology. So let's consider some time slice. I'll call it sigma t. And then we're gonna let S be a closed two-dimensional surface. That lives in sigma t. And just like we did a decomposition of four-dimensional space-time metric into basically projected that onto our slices of constant time, we can basically apply the same concept and consider the two-dimensional metric that you get by projecting the three-dimensional metric of sigma onto this surface, two-dimensional surface S. So we'll say it has induced metric QAB, and then we'll let L be a normal vector field. So we have S, some two-dimensional surface. On the surface, we have this metric QAB, and then a normal vector field L. And then we're going to define what's called the expansion. And I'll call that theta the following way. That's the lead derivative with respect to L of the natural log of square root of the determinant of this metric Q. So you can think of this as basically the fractional change in the area of the surface S in the direction of L. And we can, just using the definitions, rewrite that as this. In particular, we're going to be interested in taking L to be a null vector. We can define inward outward plus minus. So here NA is the usual normal two slices of constant time. And then SA is the unit space-like vector that's normal to S. So for example, if we were just in flat space and our surface S were just a sphere, then this unit normal would just be the unit radial vector. And then L would basically correspond to, either a null ray going outward from the sphere in the radial direction or a null ray going inward. So, and that basically determines how it changes a little bit in time. So these are unit normals. Because of these are null vectors, they're zero. And then we can choose the, basically with this normalization, if we contract the plus with the minus, we get minus two. Yeah, so now we're ready to define the what's called the outward null expansion. which is basically just this expansion with respect to L plus. And if you want to write that in terms of these 3 plus 1 quantities, you have the 3 divergence of this SI, then we had this contraction with the extrinsic curvature, and then just the trace of the extrinsic curvature. Yeah, and then now just introduce some terminology. If this outward null expansion is less than or equal to 0, everywhere on S, and then we call S outer trap surface. And in particular, if it's equal to 0, then we call it a marginally outer trapped. And that's sometimes, and then that's sometimes abbreviated as MOTS or MOTS for marginally outer trapped surface. And so now we're ready to define the apparent horizon. So the apparent horizon is just the outermost marginally outer trapped surface. So here the outer refers to the fact that I'm looking at L plus. And here outermost refers to basically just that there's no other MOTS that encompasses this marginally outer trapped surface. So we'll talk about how that might arise in a little bit. You might recognize this expression from the one we used when we were given the example of initial data, when we solved for a Schwarzschild solution and in isotropic coordinates. We basically set this to 0 at our inner boundary. And that's how we got a black hole horizon. Yeah, I think we're out of time, so we'll discuss a little bit more about the physical meanings of these apparent horizons and how they can differ from event horizons in dynamic settings next class, and then we'll start to talk about gravitational waves. So let me stop there and ask if there are any questions.